at this we're gonna do the Sunday brimstone. Got so dadgum hot it burned up a church bus in the parking lot. In a panic, the Reverend Dr. White called up an ex member that hadn't lived right. The young Joe's bare joint right across the fence. It's the same Joe's he's preached against. He said, I don't really want to be a hypocrite. I got a Sunday school class about to have fit. We're all excited about revival week and been moved by the Spirit, so to speak. With all the souls we saved and money we spent, we thought God told us to sell that tent. I got a famous evangelist supposed to come, done run out of chairs. Will you loan us, son? Joe said, well, I'm going to use the whole dang place. Ain't nine on the jukebox, amazing grace. I ain't supposed to be open because of them blue laws, but we'll open tonight, but it's all right with you. Preacher says, well, I reckon it'd be okay. The good Lord works in mysterious ways. They're going to talk about Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, and I reckon I could do it from the DJ booth. At the First Baptist Bar and Grill, it's the only church in the Bible Belt that smells like a whiskey still. When the sinners finish one more round, we'll have dinner on the ground and go inside and pray we don't get killed. The evangelist came with a well-dressed choir. They showed up around happy hour, looked around the joint and didn't take it real well. Said the white ministry has gone to hell. Miss Mills had taught youth Sunday school, and two Dickens in the back room shooting pool were sharing the Lord with a Jim Beam rep who was teaching Miss Mills some line dance steps. Reverend White was reading from the book a loop to a tall drunk trucker about the puke. He had John 3:16 memorized, trying to dry him out to get him baptized. The evangelist yelled about the lights and the bears, and what you can't see, then his old in hell, this place ain't nothing but a den of sin. That's the kind of place Baptist ought to be in. Preacher says, well, we don't really need Joe here. You didn't do a very good job last year. You only saved one sinner. That's Todd McGuire, the little SOB that set my church on fire. Joe's bear joint has done been revived. Only been here an hour and I done saved by it. Sure, it's got mirrors and a big dance floor, but I finally found the block God called me for. They're at the First Baptist Bar and Grill. It's the only church in the Bible Belt that smells like a whiskey still. Not a stained glass window anywhere in sight, just a bloodstained floor and neon lights and a communion wine, and here it's always chill. And we're here every Sunday, we're living large, we're the only church with a covered yard. And if you don't like our doctrine and think we ain't devout, we'll have our bouncers throw your butt out of the First Baptist Bar and Grill.
There you go, the First Baptist Church Bar and Grill right there. Yeah, this is March the 28th, 2015 on Saturn's Day. Yeah, we're right here in the bunker, as usual, right on the Johnny on the spot. And it's got up this morning, I couldn't believe it. It was 10 degrees. It's supposed to be springtime in the Rockies out here, in the Rocky Indianas, but it ain't 10 degrees. Boy, I'll tell you what, we had one hell of a mess last night, yeah, and I slept right through it. My gal said, you know, along about 3 in the morning, she heard the awfulest ruckus you want to believe, man, and the dogs are going absolutely crazy. She went out on the patio, and they had a great big old coon cornered. No, the four-legged coon kind, you know. And they was tearing places up, dogs trying to get to that coon, and she was trying to get the dogs away from the coon. And this morning she told me about it, and I said, I didn't hear a thing. I didn't hear one thing, and I'm usually a pretty light sleeper, but I think I know why. Last night I went up to my old friend's bar up around the lakes, and I had myself a couple of tall, what do they call those things? Long Island iced teas, and sang a few songs of karaoke. And that has never happened to me, to sleep through that kind of noise, but anyhow, that was an exciting evening, but only my gal got to enjoy it. and the dogs. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And that's where you send your donations, and it's about time for April. Several of you have got your April donations in, and I appreciate that. And also, we got those money orders off to some of the POWs, and that's going to make them happy. And let's see, also send your snail mail here to Box 401, and then go on up to resist.com and get a college education. Get an education better than Obama got. Yeah, right up there at resist.com. And don't forget, we're streaming the radio shows from the radio archives from years and years, and hundreds of radio shows. They're being streamed, so you can get them anytime. That's right. But initially, it's $20 per month to get six hour shows a week. And then after they've been out and all my premium friends and lone wolves have listened to the shows, about 2 weeks later, or maybe three, we put those shows, old shows, on the old shows archive list, and you can hear them. Tell your friends if they want a freebie, they can hear them there, and then encourage them to, you know, donate, you know, help us out here in the bunker. Well, now I'm going to go back in the archive and find something for you to play for today, and I'll take a little bit of a rest here, and we'll see what we can find. Okay, I've dug back in the archives here, and I found something I think would be good for you, and that is a book report by an author on what is called Imperial Overreach, about this empire, how it's come about, what is happening, and where it's headed. And it's about an hour, yeah. So I'll play that, send that to you. I think you'll get a lot of good information out of this particular lecture.
Hegemony, the U.S. hegemony. And you mentioned in Blowback, I think there were three elements that you saw that are analogous in our situations with ancient Rome: the internal corruption and the imperial overreach or the military overreach and the inability to reform. Would you talk about
that? That was also the USSR. That was
something Well, let me talk about the Roman comparison a little bit. The Roman Republic is extremely important to the United States. Many of our ideas come from the Roman Republic, which ended in 31 BC with the coming to power of Octavian, the grand nephew of Julius Caesar, who then became the god Augustus Caesar, the first Roman emperor, a military dictator, who was then succeeded, if I can remember them accurately, by Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius and Nero, about as awful characters as one could ever imagine. No one in his right mind should ever conceive that the Roman Empire produced good government. It produced military dictatorship. In the first two centuries, but again, just to go back to the influence of Rome on the United States, you'll recall that the great articles by Madison, Hay, and I can't remember who the third was. The great articles defending the Constitution in the Federalist Papers are all signed Publius. Well, who was Publius? He was the first Roman consul in the Roman Republic. That's where we get separation of powers, term limits, toleration of slavery, other such things. But the Roman Republic, people exercised very considerable civil rights if you were a Roman citizen. It was an early approximation of a representative government. Was a republic that, in its first two centuries, about the same length of time as our first two centuries, was ruled by elected officials who had term limits, their internal competition, a genuine and most powerful division of powers, separation of powers, that ever came along. But they began without thinking about it, to acquire an empire. In Gaul, that is in southern France, in Iberia, all of North Africa, in Asia Minor, in Greece itself, in the Greek colonies in Sicily. And until that time, the Roman legions were raised entirely from farmers. One of the things I always admired about Rome, the Roman Republic, is that conscription was not of the poorest people in the society, it was of people with a stake in the society. They were farmers. You couldn't get conscripted unless you owned a horse. And you went off and you fought, and then you came back and you had your famous triumph through the forum. And then you went right back to the farm. With the development of the empire, they began to need standing armies. Big armies that lasted for 20 years or so in order to do imperial policing all over the world. And these people, after a while, when the chief problem began to develop is, what do you do as you begin to demobilize the armies? There wasn't that much land left in Italy anymore. The Senate was filled full of conservative landowners who were not about to do a land reform. Ever so slowly, the real power in the country shifted to military commanders who now began to take an interest in the interests of their troops, i.e. military populism, associated above all with Julius Caesar, without question a military genius, but who said, I will serve your interests against the conservatives of this society. The only price is I become dictator. This is Napoleon Bonaparte, Juan Perón. Then, of course, Caesar himself was assassinated in the Senate on the Ides of March, 44 BC. It is to me astonishing that our neocons went to war in the spring of 2003 on basically the Ides of March, and they don't seem to realize why the oldest slogan I can think of Western civilization is beware the Ides of March. It is not a good time to launch a new project anywhere, as Julius Caesar himself was warned as he entered the Senate on that day. The result, however, was a shift of power to military populace, of which then a much more serious one came along, the young, youthful, almost maniac Octavian, who became Augustus Caesar and led into military dictatorship. It is one of the things that worries me in the United States today. I think it's fairly easy to imagine the end of the George Bush administration, either because he is defeated by a Democrat or he defeats himself in almost the way Lyndon Johnson did over poorly planned wars abroad. I still am not certain that whoever replaces him of either party can stand up to the interests of the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies. After all, even if you had an honest Congress, they can't do oversight when 40% of the defense budget is secret from everybody. Maybe one or two very senior members of Congress can get access to some of it. All the intelligence budgets are secret. This is a concentration of power in the executive branch that is unprecedented. Then even more sort of slightly Roman in the way of transfer of power. I mean, the Senate, by the end of the Republic, the Senate was worthless. It was a club of wealthy Romans, but who simply were there to rubber stamp anything that Caesar did. We saw this, I think, the most critical issue in our society. In October of 2002, our Congress overwhelmingly voted to give the president the right to go to war when he wanted to, on his decision alone, including the use of nuclear weapons. James Madison, easily the most important author of our Constitution, said that the clause in the Constitution reserving the right to go to war to the elected representatives of the people is the single most important clause in the Constitution. Never, ever should such a power be entrusted to a single man. In October of 2002, our Congress, both parties, kissed off the Constitution. And that's the issue today, almost more than anything else. When I began to write this in my book called The Sorrows of Empire, I was I was saying that the history would suggest to us we may begin to see in America a military populist, one who comes along, who begins to represent our legions deployed on our 725 military bases around the world, but who are not very well paid, who are not very well taken care of, whose families are often destitute in terms of trying to lead normal lives, but that who are intensely patriotic and identified with the United States, that we're waiting for the militarists to come along and say, I will serve your interests against those of vested interest in the United States. All I require is dictatorship. 2 weeks after I wrote that, General Clark entered the ranks. And I thought, oh my God, this is happening a lot faster than I thought it was going to. I thought, that is, between the death of Julius Caesar and the Battle of Actium and Octavian's emergence as the now unquestioned dictator of Rome, took about 25 years. Ours is coming along at the speed of FedEx, I'm afraid. History is a little bit faster today than it used to be. But that's to say, that's what's at stake today. Perhaps our most prominent political philosopher in this country in the post-war period, Hannah Arendt, once made the case in Origins of Totalitarianism that tyranny can always prevail over others because it doesn't require consent. Its only cost is the destruction of its own society. That's, in many ways, what our militarism, the unintended consequence of what it's doing, is to destroy our constitutional order. Indeed, militarism is very highly advanced today, and we should bear in mind probably the two most famous generals who were ever presidents of the United States, namely George Washington and Dwight Eisenhower, both in their farewell addresses famously warned us about it. That is, Washington warned of the extreme dangers, as he said, to Republican liberty of standing armies and what these lead to. Eisenhower, even more famously, in his farewell address in 1961, invented the phrase military-industrial complex. We know today that he intended to say military-industrial-congressional complex, but was warned off by his advisors that that's asking for trouble. But he spoke of the rise of unauthorized power in our society, and it's the tendency to distort our Republican form of government. I believe this distortion is now so far advanced that it is truly an open question whether you could reverse under any such circumstances, which is something that we were talking about earlier that leads to this is speculation. It's not a prediction. I'm not Cassandra, though the important thing about Cassandra is that she was right. There was something funny in that horse. And Greeks bearing gifts should be looked at very closely. She's one of the few social scientists that ever got it right. But nonetheless, without being Cassandra, I fear at times that we seem to be treading the same steps as the former Soviet Union. We now know with precision and from ample sources inside Russia of the things that brought the Soviet Union down. It had absolutely nothing to do with Ronald Reagan or Star Wars. They had been thoroughly warned off on that and understood how easily a so-called missile defense system can be defeated through decoys and things of this sort. Sakharov was brought out of internal exile in Gorky in order to address the Politburo on that subject, and he said, don't spend a nickel on it. The Soviet Union was brought down by three things, all three of which strike me as parallel in America in the first years of the 21st century. First, extreme economic rigidity driven by ideology. That is, the inability to reform our economic institutions in ways that need to be done because of the power of ideology. It was Marxism-Leninism in the case of Russia that prevented Mikhail Gorbachev from being able to improve Russian efficiency. In our society, we see it in the whole world of corporate corruption. The belief that the stock exchange is no longer a functioning market, but is in fact a club of crooks. The ripping off of workers' pension funds, the savaging of corporate profits by inside executives, as in the case of Enron, Tyco, WorldCom, whatever else you may want to say. The second, imperial overstretch. Now, this is where the issue that just came up, the fact that you get over time playing the imperial role just as Rome, as the Roman Republic did. You get too many commitments and you start making too many enemies. There's too many cases of blowback out there. I could begin to tick off for you, or put it a different way. On 9/11, my publisher in New York called me shortly after she had heard of the explosions. Her office is on West 18th Street, which is getting reasonably close to Ground Zero, and said, blowback, big time, just hit. And I'm getting out of here, but you ought to turn on the TV. One of the things we speculated on, though, is, well, who are the terrorists? We didn't automatically think that they were from the Islamic world. They could just as easily have been from Chile, Argentina, Brazil, Ecuador, as a result of Operation Condor and the things that we had done there. They could have been from East Timor. They could have been from Indonesia. They could have been from Okinawa. They could have been Greeks. After all, Greece, together with South Korea, are probably the two most anti-American democracies on Earth today. In the case of Greece, is what they remember between 1967 and 1974. The Greek colonels put in power by the Central Intelligence Agency, and probably the most repressive government supported by either side in the Cold War. Something that no Greek is going to forget. I warn American citizens about that, since the Olympic Games are going to be held in Athens next year. The Greeks are certainly thinking about it. If I were an American tourist, I'd think about it too. We'll see, if you have an alternative passport, it wouldn't be bad to use it if you happen to have a Mexican one or a Brazilian one or something like that. And then the third is just to say that imperial overstretch put the Soviet Union into a situation approaching fiscal insolvency. There were simply too many commitments. We now have, the Department of Defense acknowledges, well over 700 American military bases in other people's countries. Okay. This is, at the same time, not to mention another 300 that are at least secret, that are kept totally secret. The intelligence bases, many of the bases that we simply don't acknowledge we have, like Bon Steel in Kosovo and places like that. The bases in Great Britain that are disguised as Royal Air Force bases. Any number of installations that we don't want to publicly disclose are functioning American military bases. Imperial overstretch, that is, imperialism is a little bit like the saber-toothed tiger. Evolution doesn't work backwards. I often think about, many of you will remember in Watergate, that Nixon's chief of staff, Haldeman, one day denounced John Dean for speaking too freely about the felonies committed by the president in Congress. And he said, John, you know, once you've squeezed all the toothpaste out of the tube, it's very hard to get it back in. Well, it's a homely metaphor by a man who went to prison and a former advertising executive. But in a certain sense, that's the United States today. That's the imperial overstretch. You begin to squeeze too much out and too many commitments, too many other places, and you can't reverse it. The thing that brought down the Soviet Union was the inability to reform. And there it is an interesting fact that as a professor of international relations, we normally teach our students there are no known cases of empires that went quietly, that didn't resist their own demise, that didn't fight at the end. One of the few exceptions you might make is probably the Soviet Empire, in that Mikhail Gorbachev was trying very hard at the end to reverse the Russian Empire. He was quite ready to kiss off the satellites in East Europe, including East Germany, because he wanted better relations with France and Germany, and he and his people had begun to identify Russia as a European country, and they wanted to dismantle the Stalinist system. Nonetheless, he was stopped by vested interests in the Cold War system, in the Soviet system as structured, just as I believe today anyone in America who attempted serious reform will then run into unimaginable vested interests. I mean, we see it every time. I mean, I don't particularly like Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense, but I agree with him on the need to close bases. We have 6,000 military bases in the United States alone. He has said he'd like to close a quarter of the Army bases and a third of the air bases. I tell you, every time he even opens his mouth like that, you get a firestorm on Capitol Hill from extremely liberal senators. I mean, the senators from California, from Washington, etc., saying, oh my God, you can't close bases in my state. We, our people work there. We, they make a living making depleted uranium munitions, multiple megaton atom bombs. These are lovely little jobs that we'd like to keep. Those are vested interests. Those are serious vested interests that I don't easily see how they would be defeated except by a totally unforeseen renaissance of the American public, regaining their civic consciousness, retaking control of the country. There are the slightest signs of this. I mean, I still believe, I didn't anticipate, I don't know of anybody else who did, the remarkable power and influence of the coalition that came together in Seattle in November of 1999 against the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. This was an amazing development that, despite being absolutely savaged by the mainstream press in America as hooligans, anarchists, and everything else, they had, of course, finally discovered that the worm in globalization is that the IMF, the WTO, and the World Bank are probably the most undemocratic fake institutions that exist on Earth. They are dominated by the U.S. Treasury. They're located within hailing at 1818 H Street, within hailing distance of the Treasury. We run them, but that we run them in a covert way as if they were international organizations. That movement then spread around the world and is today enormously influential and led to, just before the American invasion of Iraq, evidence that in every democracy on earth where people could express public opinion was around 80% against the United States. And it didn't mean that the government, Mr. Aznar in Spain or Berlusconi in Italy or the poodle Blair in England were going to listen to their people. They just taught democracy. But the public was aroused, was mobilized, was sensitized. Should that continue? Should the public continue to educate itself via the internet and things like that? One could imagine a renaissance in America. Barring that, I fear, like the Soviet Union from 1989 to 1991, we are Nemesis, the goddess of vengeance, the goddess of the punisher of hubris and arrogance, awaits her meeting with us, and awaits rather impatiently. It's and it is fairly late in the day.
So let's assume that there's still a last-minute rescue possible. What would the elements of that be? What would an enlightened populace taking charge do?
One could speculate in many different ways on it, but the most obvious things are that would require a reform of Congress, a reform of the corrupted election laws. It would very possibly require almost a redivision of the basic states, which turned out to be gerrymanders. I mean, after all, North Dakota has fewer people in it than Chula Vista, California. It's an odd thing to live with, to have to live with the world of electoral votes rather than where the population actually lives and what the population actually thinks. They would then have to retake Congress and use the powers given to Congress in the Constitution to begin to cut off money to the intelligence agencies and to the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense is not a Department of Defense. It's an alternative source of government on the south bank of the Potomac River. that is increasingly expanding into numerous activities well beyond what was ever imagined as the military.
What would the people do about the military petroleum complex?
Well, obviously that needs to be brought under control. That is to say, I mean, in one sense, the problem of the military petroleum complex is going to solve itself because we're going to run out of world petroleum. I mean, that we're now using it in such a profligate manner. I mean, that we actually, people in our society, including the governor of California, take pride in driving around in automobiles that use fuel the way a tank does, namely the General Motors Hummer. We're going to run out of it. It's a finite amount. Moreover, there are huge competitive interests today that are prepared to use petroleum in a much more efficient way than we do, but that nonetheless want their share or do not wish to see it all destroyed by profligate use in North America, also with the huge production of greenhouse gases in North America as a result of this dependence on fossil fuels. But that in the meantime, I think the history of the Soviet Union and what happened after its demise should warn us that we will face remarkable resistance by vested interests in this system as constituted today, because the money involved, the jobs involved, the structures of life that we have been led to believe are indispensable to our very identity, such as the automobile as we drive it here in Southern California, where you drive home every night into unimaginable traffic jams with a single person sitting in an automobile that could carry 10. I'm not exaggerating. That's right next to you everywhere you go. This could be changed, obviously, but what is history would suggest that it was more likely to lead to conflict, but that conflicts that we are very likely now to lose. It's nowhere written that the United States must go on forever as the hegemon dominating the rest of the world. As I say, history does seem to be speeded up. If we were carrying on this conversation, say, in 1985, and I had said to you that within 5 years the Soviet Union will disappear, you would have thought, this guy is inhaling too deeply on something grown around the Berkeley campus. This is not a reliable source of information. I am here to tell you, like Nabokov talking about Gogol, it's gone. That is, Russia is not the Soviet Union. It's got a GNP about the size of the Netherlands. The place came right apart between 1989 and 1991, when they made the famous decision not to resist the Germans' desire to tear down the Berlin Wall, and that then this led into something that we in the United States could not possibly stand, what Gorbachev instituted, glasnost, opening the prisons, letting everybody out of Guantanamo, and opening the archives, revealing all the black operations of the CIA. The Russian people became so horrified once the details of the gulags were brought home to them. I mean, Solzhenitsyn had already started to introduce it, but when they began to understand the horrors of the Stalinist system, they tore the place apart. And everybody who could got out, went independent, created an independent... We'd have an independent Texas if you'd... That would not necessarily be a bad thing. The point here is to say these things happen suddenly, much more fast than you may believe, that we are not well warned. That is, a $28 billion Central Intelligence Agency whose primary function was to study the Soviet Union throughout the 1980s didn't notice that the place was coming apart economically. Now, I agree with Senator Moynihan there. This is a place to save $28 billion, I would have thought. It would have been better not to have had it than to listen to their lunatic overstatements of the threat of the Soviet Navy, the threat of Soviet weapons, strategic weapons, of how we were going to break their back economically with Ronnie Baby, Star Wars, and things of this sort. None of that happened, that the Soviet Union came apart because, for the same reason that most empires do come apart. And I'm here to argue that we're not invulnerable. That is to say, Americans often argue with me things like, are you trying to say that our decline is inevitable? I am not saying that. I am saying I cannot imagine the evidence for the opposite point of view. I cannot imagine what evidence one would produce to say, we go on forever now. We are like a polyp. We are no longer subject to the cycles of decay and of overstretch and of hubris that are so palpably apparent in our ideology, in our people, in our flag-waving patriotism, and our lack of knowledge of as elemental things as the Constitution. I mean, under Attorney General Ashcroft, two articles of the Bill of Rights are now dead letters, 4 and 6, that is, on freedom from intrusion into your home and habeas corpus, that is, the demand that the government must produce charges against you and allow you to defend yourself, give you expert legal advice in defending yourself, confront witnesses against you. The president has now arrogated to himself the power to declare somebody to be, quote, a bad guy. And a bad guy he can throw into a naval prison in Charleston, South Carolina, and throw the key away. This is not what Article 6 says the president gets to do. And yet, the American public tolerates it. That's one of the issues that would come up into this question of can you imagine a reversal? Because what would be required in this reversal is a change in the level and quality of information available to the public. They clearly are wildly misled today by a propaganda apparatus that is associated with the entertainment industry. I mean, that dominates it for commercial and commercial reasons, commercial profit, from Fox News to Verizon's control of CBS, GE's control of NBC, Disney's control of ABC. There's hardly a word put out on it that you could believe, and if you actually know something about the subject before you hear it, you know what you just heard was not true. It happens all the time. Or the happy news that follows after the first 15 minutes. It's quite literally like listening to Pravda. I traveled in Russia extensively at the height of the Brezhnev era, 1978, and it is, and as the Russians used to say, no one reads Pravda to get the news. You read Pravda to get the line. You get the news from people you trust, from your own little radio, from some ways that, from messages that friends transmit to you. I no longer read the New York Times in the news. I read it for the line. And I think we've all sort of gotten used to that. What is changing? I mean, the public opinion polls tell us that in the United States it breaks down about 70-30. About 70% of the public is behind the president, behind imperialism, behind the army. They have some doubts. They're worried. They don't like their boys being killed for the sake of George Bush's re-election or for the oil empire, but they're not ready to alter that. 30% of the public is on the other side. They believe we're heading in the wrong direction and heading there very rapidly and are worried about it. What do those 30% have? Well, they've got the internet, first of all. They're reading British newspapers, which they're reading The Independent and The Guardian, and that gives them a funny perspective on the world as far as the Pentagon is concerned. They've got The Nation magazine, and they've got Paul Krugman. That's about it. that's about. But that's enough. 30% is a very large number for our society. But one of the things that would be required would be a vast change in the kind of information available, since we now know that one of the most extraordinary sources of political power is control of the mass media in our society. That one of the things that, that was used to bring about the revolt against Hugo Chavez in Venezuela in April of last year, April 2002, was there are something like a half a dozen television stations in Venezuela. Five are owned by private interests that devoted themselves to the destruction of the government, and only one was in the hands of the president, who was able to put out a different point of view. I can't say that there's anything in the United States today that's putting out a different point of view in terms of the mass media from that of sort of the approved and copycat journalism of the networks, except of course for the Fox News, which represents an Australian fascist, and they put out a line that is fairly consistently off over in one particular corner. I mean Rupert Murdoch, of course, the owner of the News Corporation, the owner of the Fox network, and a person who uses it for his own personal political purposes.
I heard a commentator say the other day that what he's seeing now is the convergence of psyops and news.
Yes.
Or media relations. Yes.
Media relations.
Yeah, so that the
it's also a major issue in the Pentagon is to begin to develop our own news news management. I mean, yeah. That is, they've invented embedding, the lovely Pentagon euphemism, embedding otherwise reputable journalists with our military formations, more or less cutting them off in any real source of news, but having to report nothing but, well, these were basically decent guys who were scared to death that they were going into combat. Once you've read that story, but you don't need it every day, together with the power to manipulate the news in many, many ways, I don't think there was any more serious military lesson discovered by our militarists from the Vietnam War than the need to control the journalistic reporting. It started in Grenada when they invented the pool system, where no journalists get to actually go in. They get to be taken in by a lieutenant colonel and shown what they're to be shown. Yeah. The latest manifestation of this is embedding. We now understand that the Pentagon is in the process of creating their own television network that will broadcast their view of Iraq. That is, pictures of kindly young troops of the 4th Infantry Division patting kids on the head, mm-hmm. and things of this sort that would be signs that our missionaries are at work. It, of course, takes us back and reminds us again of the world of Adolf Hitler, of Leni Riefenstahl, of Joseph Goebbels, of the enormous power. Whether Riefenstahl, now just recently died, late Leni Riefenstahl, was a Nazi or not, Lord knows Adolf Hitler knew what she was capable of doing. No one, I think, will ever forget her pictures of the Nuremberg rally of 1934, mm-hmm. with Rudolf Hess in this sea of swastikas turning and saying, Mein Führer, Sieg Heil, and then comes forward Adolf Hitler to give one of his most incredible speeches ever. This was when we really did begin to discover the world of, not propaganda, the world of manipulation of the public through symbols and symbolic control, which is, I think, we suffer from it in the United States today in an extremely advanced manner, and that is, in my view, I mean, let's put it another way. Probably one of the most extraordinary patriots in our society today, and the closest thing to sort of our version of Cicero, the great defender of the old Republican Roman Senate, the believer in the way things that should be done, the man who acquiesced in the killing by his fellow senators, Cassius and Brutus, of Julius Caesar, Cicero. Our Cicero is Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia. He's out giving the most unbelievably powerful speeches in glorious rhetoric that you listen to it, and of course it's Roman rhetoric, but it's also constitutional rhetoric. It's the rhetoric of the American founding fathers. It's a rhetoric of the kinds of devices built into our society in order to protect our liberty and to prevent the development of autocratic, authoritarian governments associated with militarism, for example. But, of course, Byrd has no power, and he's an old man, and he comes from a poor state. So he's hardly listened to. What you really want to do is to see C-SPAN to always pan away from him and show you the totally empty Senate quarters as he's delivering one of his brilliant speeches. But Byrd, differing from me, believes that the American public simply awaits its moment of revelation of what's been going on. That once the citizen becomes well informed, begins to gather information on the degree to which he is being sabotaged by our ersatz political leaders, that they will then, the citizen will rise up, retake the government, purify the place. I would like to think he's right. I don't myself actually believe so. Sheila.
Hello there, Jim Jeff. Come on. You're going to get onto television? Come on. Don't run away. Come here. You've been on television before. This is not the most beautiful pickup you ever did. But there.
You are a great beauty.
Hello there, beauty. This is a Russian blue. They're not Russian cats. They're English cats.
It's
that used to be used on the ships to Murmansk because they're the world's greatest Mausers.
My new book is called The Sorrows of Empire. The subtitle is Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. In the last chapter, this book is mostly about our military overstretch and the complications of a volunteer army, of the fact that the military today bears no resemblance to people who remember service in the American military in World War II, or in my case, in the Korean War, or in the Vietnam War, when there was an obligation to serve in the armed forces as a citizen. Today, people serve in the armed forces for particular individual reasons, normally to escape some dead end of American society. They do not expect to be shot at, either. And once they start getting shot at, you can expect the reenlistment rate to reflect it.
You're talking about the poverty draft?
Well, no, I put it to you concretely. If you want to be a policeman in Atlanta, Georgia, to take the police academy test, you've got to have a couple of years of college credits. One of the ways you can get around that is to be a veteran. The 2nd Infantry Division up on the DMZ in Korea right now is absolutely filled full of people who joined the Army in order to get those credits to go back and take the police exam. It's a career planning decision, a little bit like a kid borrowing $100,000 to get his way through Stanford. This happened. I mean, when Private Jessica Lynch, who got shot up at Nasiriyah in the advance on Baghdad, when she was asked, why did you join the Army? She says, I couldn't even get a job at Walmart in Palestine, West Virginia. I joined the Army to get the hell out of Palestine, West Virginia. I thought, here comes the voice of the genuine ranks telling us what's going on in these things. But I felt at the end of this book, I was obliged to say, well, what were the sorrows of empire? And I come up with four that I discuss in some great length. The first, perpetual warfare. That is the very nature of our policies today, particularly preventative war, and the breaking of virtually all international agreements and reciprocal agreements that we have to try and maintain peace and deal with complex problems like global warming and things of this sort. As we break these things, the obvious consequence is one war after another. I mean, after all, we've had two major wars, and the century has hardly started, in Afghanistan and in Iraq, both of which resulted in what the Pentagon would like to call easy military victories, but instantaneously fell into unbelievably bloody insurgencies that can go on into the end of time. The second sorrow of empire that I identified was the loss of civil liberties, was the use of these crisis conditions, often generated, I mean, quite literally created, produced, as you would, by people with inside knowledge and the ability to manipulate them, leads to the loss of civil liberties as the public, with some understanding, is willing to forego them for the sake of trying to guarantee, at least in the short term, their immediate security. But that the rise of people like Attorney General Ashcroft and others. The third sorrow that I identified was the loss of confidence in the government because of now institutional lying based on secrecy. That is to say, Colin Powell has had a long and distinguished career as a general in the United States, including National Security Advisor to Ronald Reagan, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time of the first Bush presidency. He totally destroyed his credibility on February 5th of 2003 by openly lying to the Security Council of the United Nations about the nature of the threat posed in Iraq, and he had sitting behind him, unavoidable in every television picture, Mr. George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, as if to verify his views. He was lying, and there's not a soul left on earth who cares to hear our Secretary of State speak on any subject because you can no longer trust him. This becomes part of our political culture, that we don't, that prudent people no longer believe what they hear. Spokesman for the Department of Justice comes out and says, we have our highest priority is to maintain constitutional liberties. But obviously, anybody who's paid any attention to the United States for the last 2 years knows that the direct opposite is true. We are trying to figure out how to get around constitutional liberties and to give greater power to the FBI and the CIA and the military and to move them into our own society. I mean, we now have something called the Northern Command, located in, it's a command like CENTCOM or the Pacific Command or the European Command. We'd never created a command like that in the United States before. It was specifically avoided during the Second World War on grounds that it might become a basis for the military takeover of our government. Well, we have one now today. General Everhart, the head of Northern Command, regularly talks about how the Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibits the use of military force in policing powers in the United States, it was enacted after the Civil War, how we might have to modify that act today in order to guarantee the security of the public. I want to say, General Everhart, you don't really realize that that law was enacted to protect us not from civil disorder, but from you, from people like you in this country. The fourth of these sorrows of empire is the one that's in some ways most acute and least avoidable, and that's bankruptcy. That is, the first three are the demise of America, as the politicians say, as we know it. They are an alteration, and it's a little bit like bringing the end of the Roman Republic. That didn't end Rome, it led to what we like to call the Roman Empire, but that, it, as I say, was a military dictatorship that spent most of its time trying to hold on to the world that it had conquered, and slowly gave way to a Christian takeover, if you will, of the Roman Republic. Also, of course, a takeover by its outside enemies, Roman Empire. But the bankruptcy, which is today getting to be almost inevitable, instantaneously creates a crisis that nobody can control. I mean, it's not now whether you want to tolerate it or not, or whether you actually care about the Bill of Rights or not, or whether you ever even heard of them before. Bankruptcy brings it home to you at once. Right now, I mean, I offer you just one small statistic. Statistics are not things that are usually easily transmitted over television. Before the First World War, the British Empire had a trade surplus that was maybe, its current account surplus was maybe 7% of GDP. They were an extremely rich country. They could afford to make mistakes, as in things like the Boer War, and things like that. We have trade deficits that are the greatest in recorded economic history. They're running up to several percentage points, high percentage points of GDP. They're financed today, the fact that we consume so much more than we actually produce, and we consume it from the rest of the world, they're financed by savers around the world, usually people in East Asia, Japanese, Southeast Asians, Chinese, who want to invest in our currency, since it has this imperial quality of being the global standard, want to invest in our currency as a safe haven. It's not that safe anymore. That the value of the euro against the dollar increases to the point that's right now, as I looked at it yesterday, 125 euros to the dollar, that's getting to be quite up there. I don't object. I mean, my royalties are paid in euros, and I'm just utterly delighted. On the other hand, I would not like to travel to Bologna or Milano right now. It would be awful to have to convert dollars into euros in order to pay my hotel bill. If the savers of the world should decide, and they could almost at any moment, that the euro was a safer place to invest than the dollar because the American economy was mismanaged. And what might lead them to think that? Well, that the whole mutual fund industry is now up for grabs because of corruption at the top, and that the state of California, the public employees pension fund, one of the largest on earth, is in the process of suing the New York Stock Exchange for corruption. Should they decide to shift their funds to euros or to some other currency or just keep it themselves, the American Stock Exchange collapses. We have a howling recession, and the United States instantaneously has to finance all of its external debts by domestic savings. To do that, the interest rates would have to go up to Jimmy Carter levels, 21-22%. It'd have to really be valuable to you in America to save money and lend it to the government, and you would insist that they pay you a great deal. Now, we're not talking about something abstract here. We're talking about the fact that we have trade deficits that are running at 5% of GDP. And one of those things that we import a great deal of is petroleum, too. I mean, that we pay that to Venezuelans and to Saudi Arabians and to Indonesians and others. Then you add to that, in November of 2003, the president signed a defense budget of $401 billion. This is the biggest ever done, and it doesn't include any of the money for Iraq. That's another $150 billion. We are going deeply into serious deficits that must sooner or later be paid back or lead to a one and only time. You only do it once. You can denounce your debts. Then once you denounce your debts, you never get to borrow a nickel again in your life. You become a pauper. That we have a allegedly fiscally conservative group of leaders who are anything but fiscally conservative. They are profligate about the expending of the wealth we have. Meanwhile, the country, as workers in manufacturing discover, the country is turning into finance capitalism. What we do is we manipulate money these days. We don't manufacture very much stuff. We get it from somebody else. Or we have our companies are manufacturing it in China or in Puebla, Mexico, or in Bangladesh, or in Malaysia, or certainly there's not a computer in the country that's made in the United States today. They're easily, most of them, made in Malaysia or in Taiwan. When this happens, as Herb Stein, a Republican chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, once said, things that can't go on forever don't. We are talking about something here that can't go on forever. And it's only now a matter of time. It's not a matter of a pundit sitting here and telling you that we are at a crossroads. That's the stock in trade of what pundits do. It is to say this is something that can't go on forever. It will crack at some point. And there's a lot of people, very smart people who know a lot about money, who are preparing for the crack. That is, when the United States is squeezed dry and can't pay anything more, the same thing happens, and it happens to you at Las Vegas when you announce to the owner of the casino, I can't afford my debts. You could find yourself planted in the Las Vegas desert if you say that once too often. That's what we face. It is an almost certain result of our militarism and imperialism because they don't produce anything. They are pure expenditure. They militarism, militarism and imperialism are forever expanding, but they are not profit-making. That the military is state socialism. It has absolutely, the military-industrial complex has absolutely nothing to do with what we like in an almost sermon-like way to talk about free enterprise. You have only one customer. The federal government is not concerned with getting its money's worth. It's concerned, the military is always concerned, with effectiveness, whether you're getting the product that, that does what you want it to do, that is, at best. The missile defense budget right now, which is $8 or $9 billion, I can't remember the exact amount, this is simply allocated by Congress and given to the Department of Defense, which then goes to see the manufacturers, Teledyne and Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and they then sit down and decide how they might spend it, what might be a good way to spend it, but it's not allocated funds. The Constitution requires that the citizens be given in a, I can't remember exactly to you, but be given an honest accounting of how their tax dollars are spent on a regular basis. This clause is the clause that makes the United States a democracy, because it says it makes the separation of powers work. It means that the people, through their representatives, can find out what the executive branch is doing. That has not existed in the United States since World War II. That is, the Manhattan Project that built the atom bombs was, and remains to this day, totally secret. And that's when the precedent began of all the intelligence budgets and anything you want to bury being put into the defense budget and kept black, so-called. And it was thoroughly black until after Watergate, when we began to create committees that senior and safe senators were being given a peek at this stuff, but there are cutouts still in every one of those things, so the Secretary of Defense can, if necessary, declare this simply black and it's a matter of national security, and there's no way to appeal it. No court has anything to say about it. It's simply done by uniformed officers inside that big building in Arlington. Under these circumstances, I think it is more than likely that the American empire will come, that dismemberment, its unraveling, will begin as a result of an economic crisis, rather than over any of the things that actually concern me more, the perpetual war, loss of civil liberties, a culture of lying and propaganda in official statements of the government, and that. There, I don't believe I'm in any way alone. I think it's the collected wisdom of virtually every economist in the country that we are treading on extremely thin ice economically, and that one doesn't see any signs of recovery soon.
People talk about civil society, yeah, business, and government being the three main players, the three stools of the global, the three legs, yeah, of the global stool. But it seems to me that the military community, so-called,
yeah,
not
the establishment, yeah,
yeah, the establishment that transcends borders, you know, yeah, that have links between all themselves, the so-called intelligence community, same thing, and then organized crime, yeah, are equal, if not even more important players, and more important legs to the stool. Would you comment?
This is what I'm trying to get at in the Star Wars Empire, is the professional military, organized crime, and the intelligence community. But again, intelligence community, one of the odd things about that, I talk about it at good length in my book, since I was at one time a consultant to the old Office of National Estimates of the CIA, and do know actually something about it. intelligence organizations don't do intelligence. They're private armies of executives. That's the clandestine side of things dominates. It wags, the tail wags the dog in the CIA. That is, the intelligence is worthless, as we now know in numerous cases. But that doesn't for a moment stop the funds flowing there. And that trails off and intersects quite easily with the world of organized crime, in that the methods of clandestine activities, of overthrow of governments, of provocateurs in which you incite people to riot, have your own snipers kill a few of them, and then say that innocent bystanders were killed by the government you want overthrown. We've used that ploy so many times, from Jakarta to Caracas just recently, that it's almost insane to believe that you could see Dan Rather putting it out once again that innocent bystanders were shot by thugs of the Chavez regime, which he said just last year, when it's standard operating procedure in overthrowing a place like Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973, or things of this sort, as well as, of course, even as we know in the case of John Kennedy and his animosity against Fidel Castro, the actual use of known mobsters in the attempt, in proposed assassination attempts. Again, the purpose here not being to avoid the onus of assassination, but to avoid the onus of pulling the trigger yourself. It is also another standard American ploy to have the CIA up with a complicit military organization in which they're giving the orders, but the other people are doing it. This is, for example, you'll recall just a couple of years ago, the shooting down of an airplane over Peru that was filled full of American Baptist missionaries, that was interdicted by a CIA control plane that sent in the Peruvian Air Force to shoot it down. Well, that's very similar to the Phoenix program throughout the Vietnam War, where we killed thousands of people in similar sorts of ways. So that the other thing that I think is dangerous in all of this is to remind people once again of one of the greatest scandals in the country, and that's something called the School of the Americas, located on the base of Fort Benning, Georgia, in which we have for now decades trained thousands of thugs in state terrorism throughout Latin America. I strongly recommend to all of your viewers to look up the brilliant School of the Americas watch, www.soaw.com. And, well, there you can also look up any name of a Latin American leader, Mr. Montesinos, say, recently deposed in Peru, and find out that he not only taught at the School of Americas, he taught there twice. He was so good he was invited back on how to basically produce state terrorism in places like Guatemala, Nicaragua, El Salvador during the 1980s. So that one begins to wonder what is left for organized crime, since we've taken it over with arms sales, with the intimidation of population, the protection racket. I mean, the Chicago mobsters used to basically say, you've got to pay us to be protected. Protected from whom? From us. Well, that's very largely what America's operations today in about 130 of 170 countries in the United Nations amount to, is the protection racket. And remember, what the citizens of these countries see of the United States are uniformed special forces troops, not State Department officials, not AID officials, not even businessmen. The ones they run into most commonly and inevitably, as a matter of elementary logic, have to conclude, the Americans think in terms of enforcing their policies, not through diplomacy, not through persuasion, but through the use of military force. That's what you see of the United States today. That's in a certain sense what one again means by blowback, the disjunction between what we think we're doing in the world and what people on the receiving end know that we are actually doing, and the kinds of attitudes that they generate. I'm sorry to say, but it is true. I think today the demise of the American Empire would be no more regretted in the world than was the demise of the Soviet Empire, which was not regretted anyway.
So that wasn't too hard to understand, was it? The American Empire has started to deteriorate a long time ago, but it's speeding up, this military-industrial congressional empire. That's what Dwight Eisenhower said, congressional, and then they changed it to military-industrial complex. So anyhow, that's it, and so you must decide. You know, you got to understand that you're not going to do any particular one act that's going to turn anything around on this. And I would not expect anyone to sacrifice themselves on any individual operation, physical, that would think that they're going to change this. We're going to ride it out, and that's the only thing you can do. But the United States has become the pariah of the world. And like at the last there when he said, we've taken over the mob. The United States military and congressional complex is the mob. And they train the mobsters to go out and collect. And that's it. I'll be back on Moonsday. Terrible Tommy here. Sorry to give you bad tidings, but that's the truth. So whatever you're going to do, you better just sort of take care of your situation. 14-5.